This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Lauren Duggan, filling in for your normal host, Alan Scott. Government actions meet business decisions. Online at www.bgov.com and on air Thursdays at 11 and Fridays at 2:30 p.m. right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m. On today's Capital Impact, a collection of important topics happening in Washington that we thought you should know about. A little later in the program, we'll talk to my colleague Elizabeth Karas-Megan. She's a legislative analyst at BGov, and she's going to discuss some vulnerable senators, four incumbents on the hot seat this November. We'll discuss the dynamics of their races and what they're doing to get support from the folks back home. It could shake the Senate in the next Congress. Then, BGov finance analyst Afzal Berry has an eye on technology. He's breaking down the fight over Spectrum. That's a collection of airwaves used by all the gadgets we can't live without, from your smartphone to your tablets. Providers want more, and they're looking to government agencies to give up or share what isn't being used. He'll join us shortly. But we begin with BGov's own Rob Barnett, an energy analyst. He's going to take us through the high-octane debate over gas-powered vehicles. No, not gasoline, but natural gas. That could be a solution, albeit a complex one. Rob, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So since the dawn of the automobile, people have been searching for a way to power their cars other than oil. Is natural gas going to be the solution?
Well, it could be, but the economics right now really don't support using natural gas in a consumer vehicle. So it works in certain fleet situations, like a bus that would take folks around town, or maybe garbage trucks, things like that. But natural gas as a consumer fuel is unlikely to be something we'd see in the near term. Bloomberg government recently crunched the numbers, and simply for a consumer, it just costs more money to drive a natural gas vehicle. Now, the fuel is a little cheaper, but the cars cost more.
And what is the price of natural gas now compared to what we're used to paying at the pump for regular gas?
Well, there's two things you need to know about gas. There's natural gas commodity price, which is at a decade low, but then there's retail CNG, or compressed natural gas prices. CNG retail prices are about $2 per gallon of gasoline equivalent. Now, right now, the national average retail price for gasoline is about $3.70 a gallon, a little bit higher here in D.C. So if you buy a CNG vehicle, you're certainly going to see some savings at the pump, but you're going to pay more for the vehicle itself, about $4,000 more, up to $10,000 more.
So here's a question. If I got a car that used natural gas, where am I going to fill it up? I mean, I personally haven't seen a CNG station. Where are they around here?
Well, you're not alone. There aren't too many CNG stations. There are about 500 stations across the whole country. Now, to put that number in perspective, there are about 130,000 gasoline fueling stations. So really, there's just a drop in the bucket. It would pretty much be impossible to drive across country if you had a CNG vehicle and you wanted to make the trip to Disney World or something like that. And in certain municipalities, there really aren't stations available. Here in the D.C. area, I believe, unless something's changed in the very recent history here, the closest CNG station is in Gaithersburg, Maryland.
And what's the one after that? So how far could I get after I got from Gaithersburg? I mean, where am I going to get to?
You know, it varies. There are some stations in Maryland, Pennsylvania, Virginia, but they're spread out. You really have to have a map of where the stations are and map your route out if you're going to try and do any kind of distance driving. Really, it generally makes sense for a situation where you come back and park your vehicle in the same place every night. So if you've got a delivery truck that goes out during the day, comes back at night, you can come back, plug it in every night to your CNG refueling equipment. But for a consumer who's just trying to drive whenever and wherever, you're going to have trouble finding stations for sure.
And what's been the impediment? Is it just for people maybe that would build a station, there just aren't the cars out there and the consumer's buying it? Is that part of it?
That's right. It's really a classic chicken and egg problem. You know, consumers don't want to buy the vehicles in some sense until there's refueling stations, and folks who build the refueling stations don't want to invest all that capital until there's a market of people who would buy their fuel. One thing that's pretty interesting to note is that a CNG refueling station is quite expensive compared with a typical gasoline station. I mean, you're talking $350,000 up to, you know, millions of dollars to put in natural gas fueling equipment. The big price differential really comes down to how fast do you want to refuel your car. If you're willing to wait for a long time, you don't need to invest as much in your refueling equipment. But if you want to have that same experience of pulling up to a gas station and refueling within a few minutes, you need to invest a lot in compression equipment and big storage tanks to hold that CNG, and it adds up in terms of cost.
Let's talk about what Washington is doing about CNG vehicles. T. Boone Pickens has been out there for a while talking about natural gas and its potential role in fueling vehicles. Is Congress listening to him? What's he proposing? Have members of Congress gone their own way with ideas here?
Well, you know, right now there is a lot of political interest, in my view, in this topic, just because right now we have essentially a monopoly in terms of the kind of fuel we use to power our transport. It's an oil-based situation here in the United States. It accounts for over 90% of all transportation here in the U.S. And a lot of that oil doesn't come from the United States. So I think there's a big constituency of political folks who are interested in any way to sort of break the grip of oil on transport. That being said, there are a couple both Senate and House proposals that would increase support via tax subsidies and things like that for CNG vehicles. They've been proposed. There's a bipartisan group of both Senate and House members that support them, but unlikely to go anywhere, certainly in the current Congress. And, you know, it's an open question for looking at 2013 and beyond.
Is that modeled after the tax credit that's out there for electric vehicles? Is that kind of the same idea?
Yeah, that's right. Electric vehicles currently qualify for a $7,500 tax credit. So your Chevy Volt, your Nissan Leaf, vehicles like that get a pretty generous credit from the government if you buy one of those. There are some the proposals that are out there would extend that same credit to natural gas vehicles. It's still an open question. And frankly, if you do the analysis, if that credit were to be applied to CNG vehicles, it would really tip the economics in favor of doing CNG. You'd still have the problem with the refueling stations and things like that. You know, those would still be scarce. But in terms of pure driving, it would really take care of that extra capital you've got to invest in the vehicle up front.
So what kind of car would you get right now if you were in the marketplace? Would you go for one of these CNG vehicles? Would you do an electric vehicle or a hybrid? A gas-powered traditional car?
I think it really depends on what kind of driving you want to do. If you're thinking about commuting back and forth, a vehicle like this, maybe an electric vehicle, it could make a lot of sense. If you have a large family and take long trips with them, well, these kind of vehicles probably don't make sense. And so it really depends on how many cars your household has and whether this could fit within your mix. I don't own a car right now, so my guess would be this probably wouldn't be the first kind of vehicle I would own. But, you know, as a secondary vehicle, sure, it could make sense.
And the study you just published called Natural Gas, America's Alternative to Gasoline, that says it's part one of two. What do we have to look forward to in your second part?
Well, the second part really is going to look at the impact that the vehicles could have on gasoline demand, greenhouse gas emissions, things like that. If they were to be adopted. So we've kind of talked about the hurdles to adoption in the first paper. The second paper is going to say, let's assume we can wave our magic wand and solve all those hurdles. We'll look forward and we'll see what the market could look like if we actually saw a reasonably high penetration of these kind of vehicles. There is a greenhouse gas savings to doing CNG. So folks interested in, you know, helping the environment, there's a benefit there to that.
Great. Well, Rob Barnett, thank you so much for joining us today. As we said, Rob Barnett's an energy analyst with BGov. We're going to turn now to another issue here on BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio. Again, I'm Lauren Duggan, filling in for your normal host, Alan Scott. Joining me now is Afzal Berry. He's a finance policy analyst with the technology team at BGov. He's talking about something that's very important to all of us, the spectrum used by our smartphones and other wireless devices like those tablet devices. It's quite valuable and also very scarce. The telecom industry wants to be able to pounce on spectrum that's sitting idle. Problem is that spectrum's owned by the federal government, and they don't want to give it up. Afzal, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you have a piece here called Sharing Spectrum Doesn't Solve Shortage. Why is that?
So there are a couple of reasons, and let me just set the stage
sure.
real quick. So the A couple of weeks ago, the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, they called for spectrum sharing. So having government agencies that have been reluctant to give up their spectrum to actually share that spectrum and share it at certain times of day or certain days of the month, or share it by using technology to try to figure out when a cell phone provider can ride on that government-owned spectrum. So that's the stage, is that there's this presidential advisory council that's calling for spectrum sharing. But really, even their own report talks about how it will take up to a decade for spectrum sharing to actually go into effect. And if you look at all the data from the wireless providers, as you probably well know, within the past 5 years, there's been an explosion in demand for data. And now everyone's got a smartphone, and a lot of people have tablets, and those things are very hungry when it comes to eating up bandwidth.
Who's on this presidential council you talked about? I mean, are these people in the industry who really have a stake here, or give people an idea of what we're talking about?
Yeah, sure. There are folks in the industry, and they're very well-respected folks. And so, for example, Google's chairman, Eric Schmidt, is on the panel, and some private equity venture capitalists who are out in Silicon Valley are on the panel as well. But at the same time, this is really a first step for them. This is something where they're really trying to change the mindset when it comes to how we as a country manage this asset. And it's really a national asset, are the airwaves that we have and how we allocate that across to different companies.
And what's so hard about making spectrum available to the wireless companies? I mean, I assume they're willing to pay a lot of money to get access to this. So what's been the holdup?
Yeah, no, they have been willing to pay billions for spectrum that has been repackaged, taken away from government agencies and sold to them. So there's definitely a willingness to pay, and consumers are willing to pay their wireless providers on that end. Really, the issue, there are two things. One is technical. So if a Defense Department agency or if another agency in the government is using that spectrum, even if they're only using it one day a month, or even if they're only using it in certain areas of the country, they have lots of systems that are developed around using particular frequencies, and shifting those systems costs money. So it takes time to shift those systems out. It costs money to do that, and there's not a lot of ready available cash to do that. And then the second half of that is when it comes to spectrum sharing itself, agencies are the technology isn't really there yet to allow them to say, okay, well, we're only going to use it that one day of the month. Everyone else can use it the rest of the time. And the FCC is trying to develop that technology, try to spur development of that technology, but it's not there yet.
Right. So how would the sharing actually work then? Is it all a technical problem that my device would work on this spectrum at this time of day, yours would work a different type of day? So, how would that look?
So there are two ways that have been proposed. One is exactly that. So my device will use spectrum on this type of spectrum in this location, because spectrum is geographic dependent,
right,
at a certain time of day or a certain day of the month. And it would have to look up on a massive database to try to figure out when your device itself would look up on a massive database to figure out when they can use what spectrum. That is one technology challenge. The other way of doing it is to actually dynamically notice. So right now, that's the way Wi-Fi works. Everyone's familiar with Wi-Fi, but you also have the challenge of when you pack too much Wi-Fi into one high-rise building, it doesn't work too well. The way it works is it dynamically notices, okay, well, someone else is using this channel, I'm going to use a different channel. And the technology is there for when it comes to Wi-Fi. It's not quite there when it comes to the wireless devices that we use every day.
Great. Spectrum currency, that's another thing you talk about, which is sort of interesting to me, just that term. What is that going to look like?
Yeah, so that's more on the economic side and less on the technical side. So that's a recognition that right now the federal agencies who hold on to the spectrum don't really have any incentive to move or to invest in changing their systems to be able to be dynamic, right? So right now it's just an allocation that they were given many years ago and that they're holding on to. And the idea of spectrum currency is to say, well, instead of you holding on to that spectrum, we'll give you a certain amount of currency to be able to either buy spectrum that you need. And it's a fictional currency. It's something that OMB would create. And
that's the Office of Management and Budget, right?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. And PCAST, which is this presidential advisory council, they actually kind of punted to OMB. They said, here's a great economic idea. OMB will figure it out.
they have a lot on their plate right now, so that might be. So best case scenario, when could the PCAST proposal take effect, and when might we all get more spectrum to play our video games and call our loved ones?
Yeah, so for spectrum sharing itself, they're looking at 7 to 10 years at the earliest. And really that's kind of assuming that all the technology is actually going to be developed and in place and figuring out those technical challenges.
Well, great, Absol. Thank you for coming in and providing us with information on this. We hope you'll come back and talk to us about more issues in this space. Again, this is BGov's Capital Impact. That's Absol Berry, a finance policy analyst with our technology team. I'm Lauren Duggan, filling in for Alan Scott. Let's switch gears again to talk about Congress. That's a subject near and dear to my heart, as regular listeners will know. The House and Senate just left for recess this week, and they won't be here for about 5 weeks. Now, many of them will be in Tampa and Charlotte coming for the upcoming conventions, but most of them will be back home trying to get reelected in their states and their districts. There's a few that need to campaign harder than others because they face really tight races for reelection. Joining me now is Elizabeth Karasmigan, one of my colleagues at BGov. She's been diving into the records of 4 of the senators who are considered most vulnerable this fall. She joins us now. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thanks.
So you have a 2-part study, one that's already come out and one that's coming out, reviewing the records of 4 senators. If there's a third of the Senate up right now, how did you choose these 4?
Sure. Well, out of the 22 senators that are running for reelection this year, 4 senators, Democrats Claire McCaskill of Missouri and John Tester of Montana, and Republican Scott Brown of Massachusetts and Dean Heller of Nevada, all face the toughest races in November. And also, these senators are facing interesting political dynamics, whether it's running as a Republican in a blue state of Massachusetts or running as a Democrat in a red state such as Montana, or running for reelection in what's known as a swing state. This is not a monochromatic group.
So one of the thrusts of the introduction to your study is about the elimination of earmarks this Congress. And those are those projects that are set aside in spending bills or in authorization bills where a little bit of money gets pushed towards a state or a district. What is the ban on those earmarks meant to senators who are facing these kind of tough races?
Well, in general, for all senators, this means that one tool of generating home state support was essentially taken off the table. It means they're relying more heavily on what legislation they introduce, the votes they cast, and also on informal methods like touring home state businesses and helping constituents navigate the federal bureaucracy. Now, that being said, for 2 of the senators in this study, the earmark ban actually doesn't mean a change in their behavior. McCaskill and Brown are both vocal opponents of earmarks, and they didn't request any in fiscal year 2010, which was the last chance they had to before the ban.
Now, the meat of your study is on the type of bills that they're introducing, and in particular the ones that help businesses, which meets our mission here at BGov, which is the business implications of government actions. So let's take a look first at Scott Brown, who won that, you know, it was a banner victory for him in 2010 when he won the seat of Ted Kennedy, changed the whole political dynamic in the Senate. He does face a tough race this year. Who's he running against, and what's he been up to since he took his seat in 2010?
Sure. Well, Scott Brown is running against Elizabeth Warren, who was instrumental in creating the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which part of the Dodd-Frank Act that passed in 2010. And what Scott Brown is focusing on is his key business constituencies, including government contractors such as Raytheon, medical device makers such as Thermo Fisher, and also the Massachusetts fishing industry. He's introduced several pieces of legislation that would benefit each of these groups, and he touts the bills as he tours the state.
Now, the fishing industry, what sort of thing is he trying to do to help them?
Sure. Well, a lot of Scott Brown's fishing industry bills are related to lowering regulations or reining in the NOAA and other government regulators of the fishing industry so they have a shorter leash in what they can do as far as bringing fishing, mostly wholesale fish markets, into line with federal regulations.
And on the medical device front, is that something out of the president's health care line, I'm assuming?
Correct. Well, part of it is. So he did sponsor the legislation that ended up repealing the medical – or that would have repealed the medical device tax in the Senate. And he also proposed streamlining a certain regulatory process for medical devices called the de novo process. So it's not only tax and it's not only related to healthcare reform. He also has broader structural changes in mind for the industry.
So that's Scott Brown. Claire McCaskill, she just won her primary yesterday, and she now knows who her opponent is because he won his, too. So let's talk a little bit about that race out in Missouri, and then we'll turn to her legislation.
Sure. Well, McCaskill is now, as we know, facing Representative Todd Akin, a conservative from the state, and the person that reportedly she would like to face. I think she feels like it sets a nice contrast to her record. In McCaskill's record, she's introduced legislation that's aimed at benefiting Missouri businesses, including those in the agricultural sector. One of these is a bill that would prevent the EPA from regulating so-called farm dust, which has been a hot debate in town. She also proposed trade law changes that would benefit Missouri manufacturers and regulatory changes for utilities such as Ameren Missouri.
Now, with Scott Brown and Claire McCaskill, what are they doing to set themselves apart from other members of their party? You mentioned that Massachusetts, one of the bluest states in the country, Scott Brown's a Republican, and I guess Missouri is more of a toss-up, I think you put it in, but obviously that'll make it a tight race for a Democrat facing a Republican who has some success winning in the state. So, I mean, how do you see that kind of shaking out?
Sure. Well, I'd say that both senators have taken votes that set themselves apart from the party. For example, Scott Brown voted for the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which the majority of his party voted against. And Claire McCaskill, for example, voted for the Keystone Pipeline to be built. So there's just a couple examples of times they've deviated from their party line votes.
And do you read anything into McCaskill's announcement that she's not going to the convention?
Well, I think coming from a state like Missouri, it's probably helpful to distance yourself from being seen as one of the Washington, one in the Washington scene. So it really gives her a chance to say that she's focusing on her home state matters.
Can you give us a little preview of Tester and Heller? I know the study's not out quite yet, maybe in the very near future. But what are some of the things you've found looking into their records?
Sure. Well, looking into their records, we looked at Tester's legislation that benefits insurance agents, as well as firearms manufacturers and dealers, such as the Montana Rifle Company. It also takes a look at Heller's legislation that benefits companies in Nevada's tourist industry, such as Las Vegas Sands, gaming machine makers, such as International Game Technology, and mining companies that are prevalent in the state.
Great. And there are two races. Tester is running in Montana. Is that another example of, is that a pretty blue state or a red state? How would you characterize Montana?
Sure. I would definitely characterize Montana as a red state. And Tester, as a Democrat, faces certain challenges running in that state. And I would point to some of his firearms industry legislation as an example of Tester trying to really reach out to some of the more rural conservative constituencies, as well as what is a budding industry in the state. You're seeing a lot of firearms makers locating in the state in the last few years.
And his opponent is, as I understand it, the House member for Montana, right?
That's correct.
So this is somebody else who has a statewide record of winning elections because there's only one representative out there.
Exactly. So it's an interesting dynamic in that state as well.
Absolutely. And then Heller, he's running in Nevada, which is the home state of the Senate Democratic leader, Harry Reid. Is Reid going to play a role in that race?
Well, I don't know how much Reid will weigh in that race at this point, but I have noticed that some of the legislation that Heller has introduced are bills that are near and dear to Reid's heart, such as putting rules into place where government agencies can't ban certain events from happening in cities like Las Vegas, in tourist destinations. That's something Reid and Heller are on the same page, regardless of party lines. It's good for their home state businesses and a place where they're in agreement.
And is that in a result of the GSA situation, the General Services Administration?
That's correct. It's a result of the Inspector General for the GSA's report that too much money was spent in inappropriate ways in a conference room in Las Vegas.
I know you also watch Congress pretty closely. What are you looking forward to in the fall as Congress comes back? You expect a busy agenda, I'm assuming?
I think everybody does, Lauren, that's for sure. With the fiscal cliff, the expiration of the tax cuts, impending sequestration, forget about the other must-pass piece of legislation, I think Congress will have its hands full.
Well, I hope you get a good break this August then while they're away on recess. I know I'm taking one.
You as well.
Well, Elizabeth Karas-Megan, legislative analyst at eGov, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, and thanks again to everyone out there for listening to the show today, whether at home, in your car, or in the office. And thanks to all my guests, Afzal Berry, Rob Arnett, and Elizabeth Karas-Megan. We'll get together again next Thursday at 11 a.m., just as we do every week. We'll have plenty more to say about the business implications of government actions, although Alan Scott will be back in his chair. For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., I'm Lauren Duggan.